So last week we heard from Paul, and he shared about the character of Solomon. And Solomon, as you know, was an incredible king. He, in fact, he presided over the reign over Israel during its most prosperous period ever. And God blessed him. God asked him, "What would you have me do for you?" And he prayed for wisdom, and God was really pleased with that request. And so not only did he bless him with wisdom, but he also gave him wealth and fame and everything else along with it, and which was fantastic. But sadly, the gifts that God blessed him with, he didn't use to follow God wholeheartedly. In fact, just as a reminder, flip back. We're going to come to 2 Kings in a second. Flip back to 1 Kings chapter 11, just to remind ourselves of what actually happened there. So this is around 970 BC. It's around that period. And in 1 Kings 11, we see in verse 1, King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughter, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites. They're from nations about which the Lord had told Israelites, you must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. I could never quite marry that statement together. He held fast to them in love. There were 700 of them, plus another 300 on top. It's like, how do you manage to love 1,000 women? But anyway, as God predicted, they did turn his heart away from following God. In verse 4, as Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord, as he did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. He did the same for all his foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. The Lord became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep the Lord's command. So the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I'll not do it during your lifetime. I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I'll not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." You know, it's so sad that Israel was an incredible nation. God had blessed them. God had given them peace. They were respected by all the surrounding nations and countries. People would travel for literally hundreds of miles to hear the wisdom that Solomon had received from God. He had an incredible income, as we talked about last week. And he was blessed in so many ways, but he compromised. He compromised and he didn't follow God's commands, and it led him astray in later life. He ended up building he built the temple that God had promised his father David he would allow his son to build. And it was a center of all worship for the Jews. But then later on, he began to build altars on the high places for his wives who worshipped other gods. And he himself was led astray. It could have been incredible. It could have been amazing. But because of his sin, then his descendants and all the future generations suffered. And so, as God promised, God tore away the kingdom from his son Rehoboam. And so Rehoboam then, when he came to the throne, he didn't listen to the advice he was given by the elders. And instead he followed the advice of his peers. And he was harsh to the people. And so they decided, forget this, we're going to go off somewhere else. And so 10 of the 12 tribes separated and the kingdom was divided. And so then you had the kingdom in the north, which is the kingdom of Israel. And then you had the kingdom in the south, which is the kingdom of Judah. And so Rehoboam reigned from the city of David, from Jerusalem, over the southern kingdom of Judah. And then Jeroboam, one of Solomon's subordinates ended up leading the Northern Empire. And eventually, the Northern Empire, because they didn't want to worship in the temple in the south, they also set up high places, just as Solomon had done. And they began to worship other gods and everything else, and it was just a mess. Let's skip forward 200 years. 200 years later. And we're going to look at Hezekiah. So in verse 1 of chapter 18, it says, "In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign." So when they give the dates, they're giving the dates for both the king in the Northern Empire, who at this point was Hoshea, and then they also give the dates for the king in the Southern Empire, which now it's Hezekiah has taken over from his father Ahaz. In verse 2, it says he was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother's name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down the Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan. Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not cease to follow him. He kept the commands of the Lord he had given Moses, and the Lord was with him. He was successful in whatever he undertook. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. From watchtower to fortified city, he defeated the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory. What an incredible resume. I mean, seriously, here's a man who the Bible says that there was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. That he trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. He held fast to him. He did not cease to follow him. He kept the commands. That's amazing. You know, this is that time of the year where I get a lot of requests to write letters of recommendation for children who are about to go into secondary schools. And there are a number of schools that require just, you know, are they from a Christian background and this kind of stuff. And so I have to write these various letters and everything. And, you know, in the letters, when I talk about the children, I don't talk about, well, they were really naughty in children's ministry last week and they have a habit of leaving litter lying around and, you know, sometimes they run in the corridors when they shouldn't. And I don't put that stuff. What I do is I give an overview. They're a great kid. You know, I'll talk about the family's commitment. I'll talk about their parents' attendance at church, how they give to the contribution, how they serve, whether it's as ushers or as class teachers or whatever. And what I will do is I'll pick out all the good things I can think of and give a generally very positive perspective. That's not to say, as I write this letter of recommendation, that this individual or this family or is perfect without flaws. That's not to say that. But I'm given a positive overview. Because if we wanted to, we could all pick up on all the flaws in all of our lives. That's so easy to do. It's easy to find all the areas that we messed up in. Here we see Hezekiah's overview, and it's incredibly positive. But as you look into the detail, you'll realize, actually, there were areas of weakness in his life. In fact, at one point later on in his life, the Bible says that God left him for a time because of his pride and to test him. And because of his pride, he ended up showing some of the treasures of the temple to some envoys from Babylon who took note and then years later came and invaded it and took all the good things that he'd shown them away. But so he was, and you know, his son Manasseh was really a vile, unlikable individual. And so it wasn't like Hezekiah was a great dad in so many ways. And yet the picture you get of him was he was awesome. He was unlike any king either before or after. You know, you get the same picture of David, for example. David, the Bible talks about how he was a man after God's own heart. But of course, David, he lusted, he lied, committed adultery, he ended up committing murder. But he was a man after God's own heart. And the Bible says that he walked in, and yet every other king is compared to David. Which is amazing. And even here, Hezekiah is compared to in verse 3, he says, He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. Of course, when he says father in the Hebrew, that means ancestor. But he did what was right in the eyes of God. And so when God looks at us, isn't it encouraging to know that he doesn't look at all our faults and flaws? Because sometimes we do that enough for ourselves. But God is a God of grace. And he looks at us and he says, you know what, let me see what is going on. Just generally, how are you doing? And you know, we do the same in our own family, or hopefully we should do the same in our own family. You know, people often ask me, so how are your kids doing? And I'll say, yeah, they're doing well. And I'll talk about this and I'll talk about that. I don't talk about the fact that I had to tell them for the 15th time to pick up their rubbish and to put their clothes in the laundry basket and to take their dishes out of their room and all that kind of stuff. You know, recently, over the summer, we had an infestation of fruit flies. You know, those little, they're not quite mosquitoes, they're not gnats. They're when I was at school studying biology A-level, we had to do some genetic experiments. And we use fruit flies. Their proper name is Drosophila. And the reason why we use these fruit flies is because they reproduce very, very quickly. I think they have a very short lifespan, a life cycle. I think it's numbered in the days, not weeks. And so they're born, they grow up, they have kids, and then they die in a very short period of time. So then you can look at many generations of their offspring to see the impact of the genetic material. And I know this is going over. But nonetheless, to say they reproduce very quickly, all right? That's the whole point. And if you have a few in your house, you know, if you have some fruit that's gone a little bit past its best eaten by date, then these fruit flies, they can multiply very, very quickly. And we had an infestation. I'm talking, I hate flies at the best of time, but these little things just irritate me. In the house, I'd be seeing these little flies and I'd be killing them, and I'd keep track of how many I kill. One in the space of 1 hour at one point during the summer, I think I must have killed 23 of these things. And you think, how many of them are there? And in the end, I was like, this is annoying to me. And so I went on the internet to find out what can I do to get rid of these things. And to get rid of them, one suggestion was you get some apple cider vinegar, put it into a glass, and cover it with some cling film, put some little holes in, because the apple cider vinegar, the scent that's released is like rotting fruit. And so they're attracted to this thing, and they crawl through these little holes in the cling film that you put in, and they can't get out again. And eventually they end up drowning in the vinegar. So I tried this, and I stuck one in the kitchen near to just a little way from where the fruit basket was. And honestly, within the space of an hour, I came back, and there were 5 dead Drosophila in there. I thought, wow, a result. Came back 2 hours later, there are 24 dead flies in there. I even took a picture on my phone. I was going to show you. But I'm not going to do that. It's pretty gross. And I thought, this is great. I'm getting rid of these things. And you know what? I did this over a period of days, and it was more and more. And I kept having to replace these glasses. And then I thought, okay, let me put out more than one glass. And so if you came to our house in the last few weeks and you've seen these wine glasses with vinegar in, you know what that's all about. So I put them all around, and all these flies would be attracted. But for the life of me, I kept thinking, I couldn't understand why after about 4 or 5 days and killing literally hundreds of these things, why there were still so many flying around. Then I went upstairs into my children's rooms. And I realized that these flies, they had a safe haven. And so I stuck some in my children's rooms. And honestly, I kid you not, in this very short period of time, we're talking 50 of these things in these glasses I stuck in there. It was unbelievable. And eventually, so after doing that, all the flies went. So, what point am I making? I don't tell people about my kids' hygiene habits because I want to give them a good positive overview. But the thing is, with these flies, unless you eradicate all of them, they're going to just keep coming back. What's interesting about this passage here is 200 years after Solomon had set up the high places, It was only now that they were being eradicated. There were a number of good kings before Hezekiah, but they didn't deal with the issues. Now, they did lots of great things. It's not to say they were bad kings. They did lots of good things, but they weren't completely, totally committed in eradicating just the idolatry in the land. I'll give you an example. So go back to 1 Kings chapter 15. In 1 Kings 15, we see in verse 11, Asa was one of the good kings. And it says, Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done. He expelled the male shrine prostitutes from the land. He got rid of all the idols his fathers had made. He even deposed his grandmother, Maacah, from her position as queen mother because she had made a repulsive Asherah pole. Asa cut the pole down and burned it in the Kidron Valley. Although he did not remove the high places, Asa's heart was fully committed to the Lord. Asa was one of the good kings. He did what was right, even to the point of dealing with his own relatives who had fallen into idolatry. And he cut down the Asherah pole and destroyed the idols that his fathers had made. But he didn't deal with all the other places of idol worship throughout the nation. And so it was allowed to continue. Look in chapter 22. In 1 Kings 22. And let's look at the king Jehoshaphat, who was another good king in Israel. In Judah, sorry. In verse 43, it says, in everything he walked in the ways of his father Asa. That's his ancestor, Asa. And did not stray from them. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. The high places, however, were not removed, and the people continued to offer sacrifices and burn incense there. Jehoshaphat was also at peace with the king of Israel. You know, Jehoshaphat was considered to be a good king, but because he didn't remove all the high places, the people were still allowed to continue in idolatry. Look in 2 Kings chapter 12. In 2 Kings 12, and we're going to look at Joash. Now, Joash, again, was considered to be a really good king in Judah. In verse 2, it says, Joash did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all the years Jehoiada the priest instructed him. The high places, however, were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifices and burn incense there. He did what was right, but he didn't remove the high places, and so people continued to fall into sin. In chapter 14, Amaziah was also considered to be a good king. In chapter 14, verse 3, it says he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, but not as his father David had done. In everything he followed the example of his father Joash. The high places, however, were not removed. The people continued to offer sacrifices and burn incense there. You know, these were good kings. And yet, you get the sense of they were good kings, but. They were good kings, however. And you know, when you read someone's resume, and you see all the good things, that's the way it should be. But when you come across a resume which is like, this is great, this is great, this is great, however, you think, ooh, not so good. Not so good. Hezekiah was the first king in 200 years where the Bible said he did what was right and he removed the high places. And you get the sense of, wow, God was pleased. You know, I've only got 2 points this morning, and the first point is simply this. Totally devoted. Hezekiah was totally devoted. Totally devoted doesn't mean he was perfect. But totally devoted does mean that there were no areas in his life or in his kingdom that he wasn't afraid to deal with. That he went there. The other kings before him, they were good kings, but they didn't go the whole way. They got rid of idol worship in their own home, and they got rid of idol worship in their immediate family, but then when it came to the wider community, they stopped just short of dealing with the problem. It's like with the fruit flies. If you just deal with one area, it's going to keep coming back. But you've got to deal with all of it. You know, if someone were to give a resume of the East London Church of Christ, I think if people came in, they would say, nice people. joyful, happy, some good singers, committed. They have services not just on a Sunday but on a Friday, and also they have small group meetings all around East London, and people go along, and it's incredible. And I think people can give a generally positive view. But if you were to dig a little bit deeper, and if you were to highlight the flaws, it's so easy to say, well, let's just gloss over those. Let's just not deal with every... Let's just be happy with how we are doing. But is that what we really want? Do we want to have the kind of resume which is like, really great person, however? Or do we want to have the resume like Hezekiah had? That he did it all. That in everything he did, in verse 7 it says, he was successful in whatever he undertook. Isn't that the kind of resume that we want? The kind of overview, the kind of profile which says, wow, they weren't afraid to go the whole way. We have a great bunch of Christians here in the East. But let me just, if I may, just share some of the things that I think we could do better in. I think our singing is fantastic, but sometimes we're not all involved. I'm guilty. I was thinking about this even as I was working my message this morning, and I was standing in the front, and during that first song, I was just in the middle of something. We started singing, and I was working on my iPad, and I thought, hold on a second. Oops. I shouldn't be doing this while we're singing. And so I put it away. But I'm guilty of this. But some of us are also guilty. That we get distracted. That we're not fully engaged. Punctuality. You know, at 11 o'clock when we started, if you looked around the hall, we were probably maybe two-thirds here. And so 30% arrived after we've already started. And it's great that you came. Fantastic. You know, better late than never, they say. But better not late. Every week, Ian Collier sends me a text asking me, who's doing communion tomorrow? And so usually I reply, sometimes I'm really on top of my game and I'll actually give him a few names in advance. I'll say, this person's doing it this week, this person's doing that next week. Yesterday he sent me a text and I completely forgot about it. And then it was at 10:30 at night, Julie happened to ask me, did you get a message from Ian? And I don't know whether he contacted Julie or not. I thought, I didn't tell him who's doing communion tomorrow. Because, of course, Ian oversees the children's ministry, and along with his wife, Carmen, does a fantastic job of that. But and so he wants to take care of the communion for the children's ministry. And so he needs to know who's doing what and everything else. And so last night at 10:30, I was sending him a text. I said, oh, really sorry, yeah, it's Ben Whitworth is doing this. And at the same time, I realized, Ben, I need to make sure that he's on top of it. And so I sent Ben a reminder as well. And of course, Ben's totally on top of it. It was his birthday yesterday as well, by the way. Happy birthday. It's fantastic. And Ian sends me back a text saying, thanks, Mike. Better late than never. Better not late. You know, seriously, it changes the atmosphere. When we all come to church on time, it's fantastic. And we all get to enjoy each other's company that little bit more. And that's the way it should be. I think we've got to not be afraid to talk about some of these things. Last week I talked about in the brothers' class, just about my discipling time with Andy. And we're just talking about confessing sin. And Andy's the one who initiated it. And he initiated it because, like Jane, Sandra happened to ask Andy, so how are things going? And, you know, are you talking to the brothers about temptations and struggles? And so Andy said, hey, Mike, I've not talked about this for a while, so let me share some of these things. And so then I shared some things with Andy. But it made me realize we've not been consistent. I've not been consistent in asking the people that I disciple, hey, how are things going? There's a brother who I disciple, who I work with and mentor, and that's Leslie Chinwezi, who I really appreciate. You know, Leslie is a brother who is not afraid to challenge me. He did it again on Friday night. Really appreciate that. And I really do appreciate it. But he'll pick me up on things. He'll say, Mike, when you said this, it was incentive. Mike, when you did that, which is incentive. Mike, how's your purity? How are things going? And he'll ask me, how are things going? And I appreciate that. You know what? It may be uncomfortable in the moment, But later on, aren't you grateful for people who are not afraid to go the whole way and get involved? Some of us, we fear that. We fear the spotlight being turned on us, which is why we don't turn the spotlight on anyone else. We have this secret pact with all of our neighbors and friends. I won't ask you if you don't ask me. I won't challenge you if you don't challenge me. That's not the way it should be. Isn't our desire to be totally devoted? And if that is our desire, then don't we welcome